Hello, Duke fans, and welcome to episode number 530 of the Duke Basketball Roundup. It is Sunday, August 13th, 2023. We are in the middle of August. Football season is around the corner, but of course we have some basketball news to discuss, and I guess football in the form of conference realignment, which was kind of crazy over the last couple of weeks. First off, introductions, in case you don't know who we are. I am Donald Wine. I am your host for this episode. Jason Evans could not be here with us. I just got back from the Women's World Cup in Australia and New Zealand. And as I came back, Jason loved me so much that he left on his own vacation. He is on a cruise in Norway and Iceland. If any of you have been on a cruise before, you know that Wi-Fi is pretty much non-existent when you're on those. Also, he's in Norway and Iceland. He should be focused on that. But I do have my good friend Sam Klein here with me. Sam, good morning. How are you?
Just at home. Just regular at home, no trip. So, Donald, I guess very quickly, despite the disappointment of the U.S. women's national team, how was the trip?
The trip was great. Yes, results notwithstanding, you know, New Zealand, Australia. I've been to Australia before. New Zealand, I had not been to. The last episode that we recorded, I recorded from Auckland. Just a fascinating place. The people were great. Everything about the trip was terrific, with the exception of the results on the field. Obviously, the World Cup is still going on, so my sleep schedule has not quite returned to normal because these games are in the middle of the night here in the United States, and I have been either going to bed early or just taking a quick nap at night just so I can wake up to watch the rest of these games. I have one more week of that, but I think I'll talk more about the soccer side of things over my podcast, the USA Soccer Cast. So if any of you want to go over there and listen to that, there will be a couple of episodes this week kind of recapping the World Cup experience. But great time. Glad I went. But I'm back and glad to be discussing Duke basketball with you, Sam. But Sam, while we were gone, obviously the viewers can't see this, but you know, we've talked about your moving situation. You are in some new digs. How are they so far? How's the movement treating you?
Totally fine. Still in Cambridge, but yeah, new apartment, most of the same stuff. Just been a weird time, but I'm good. I'm ready to talk, recruiting and conference realignment, like all the sort of non-court on the court stuff that we love to do in August.
Yeah. Well, you know what? We'll talk about conference realignment after the break. Obviously while I was gone, a lot happened there, but we want to get into recruiting because there was a couple of recruiting notes that happened just in the last couple of days that I think Duke fans are interested in discussing. The first one, last night, as we record on Sunday, August 13th, last night, Flory Badungu, who was recruited by Duke, opted to not go to Duke. He's instead going to Kansas. He was also considering Auburn and Michigan in addition to Duke and Kansas, but I think in the last few days, we had heard that Flory Badunga was very interested in coming to Duke, but that there was a lot of other factors in the name of name, image, and likeness that maybe steered him towards Kansas. But Sam, I want you to comment on Flory Badunga, who, again, goes to PVI. So he's a teammate of Darren Harris, who has committed to Duke, but he will not be joining his teammate in Durham. Your thoughts on Flory Badunga going to Kansas?
Well, the most interesting thing about this, I feel like, was right before he committed to Kansas, there was all this chatter that he was actually going to be going to Auburn because Auburn was apparently throwing some Auburn boosters, at least, were going to throw a large bag at him. And then he changed his mind and is going to Kansas instead. We told you that he was a really interesting prospect for Duke. He's one of the most highly rated players in the 2024 class, the class that are rising seniors right now. And on the one hand, would be, you know, great news if Flory Badunga had changed his mind or had decided that he wanted to be in Durham. But there are a few possibilities for reasons why he might not be coming, not the least of which is, you know, Kansas is a great program. Auburn has sent a lot of guys to the NBA recently. Like, it's not like he had a shortage of like, you know, mediocre options and then Duke, right? Duke is losing a recruiting battle here too. To other you know, in the case of Kansas Blue Bloods, and if Auburn came in second place here, a school that is recruiting pretty well in recent years. So I don't think this is something Duke fans should be getting themselves down on. But back to the situation, sort of in the front court for Duke, Kyle Filipowski's coming back this year. If he, you know, continues on his path of wanting to stick around long enough to get his degree, I don't know how likely that is to happen. But if it does, then that's a guy who is, you know, standing between Flory Badunga and 30 minutes a game. Cooper Flagg, who I know we're going to talk about soon, might be an option for Duke as well in the front court. I don't think that he and Badunga play exactly the same position, but another guy to be tussling with. Sean Stewart is already on the roster. So there are lots of places where you could see Flory Badunga looking at this lineup, looking at himself as a one-and-done prospect and thinking maybe there aren't 25 or 30 minutes a game on this squad, or maybe they're not guaranteed for me. That being said, it's interesting that he chose Kansas because by all reports, Hunter Dickinson is planning to take both of his additional years of eligibility there. So we'll see how that works out for Flory Badunga. I'm a little disappointed because obviously any top five guy that's interested in Duke is someone that I want to see in Durham, but I don't think this is a dire situation. And frankly, Duke's been doing so well in the recruiting trail in the last couple of years that maybe a little bit of humbling isn't so bad for John Shire and his staff.
Yeah, you can't win them all. We'd love to win them all, but you just can't. You can't win all the recruiting battles. But also, Sam, you were talking about some of the logjam that we have at the four and the five and the positions that Flory Badunga would play. You mentioned Sean Stewart being around Kyle Filipowski if he decides to stay for his junior season. We at this point, we don't think that's likely, but it's obviously possible. You also have Christian Reeves. You have TJ Power. You have a lot of guys there who will be factoring into those 4 and 5 minutes that are going to be distributed. And like you said, if you are a one and done type of player, or you feel like you're a one and done type of player, you want to get as much minutes as possible. And, you know, Kansas might be the place where he can get those minutes, even if he's playing alongside Hunter Dickinson. So it's funny, you know, a school that has become kind of a one and done factory over the last few years, John Shire comes in and kind of gives us a little bit of stability and consistency, and that might have helped rule out one of the top players in the class from coming here. And you know, in addition to a lot of other factors, but yes, Flory Badunga, I agree with you. It would have been great to have him on the squad, but he's not going to be someone where we're going to be scrambling. There's obviously a lot of other center prospects out there. I know Patrick Ngongba was someone that we kind of looked at earlier. It sounds like we are cooling on him as well. And maybe it just may be where the recruiting that John Shire and this coaching staff is going to do is to keep some of these guys on the current team in Durham for another year. And that might be the recruiting that they are going to be doing over the next 12 months. So let's move on. You mentioned one other guy that made some news over the last couple of days, and that's Cooper Flagg. Cooper Flagg, who was the number two player in the class of 2025, has now reclassified. He is reclassified to the class of 2024, which is this senior class. He will graduate from high school at the end of this academic year, and he is now the number one prospect in that class. That just tells you how good Cooper Flagg has been over the last couple of years. You know, we've talked about him a lot on this show. Between him and Cameron Boozer, these guys are most people consider the top two players in high school, regardless of class. But now Cooper Flagg, who we've talked about his age, he will be 18 next year. He will be eligible, just barely eligible, to enter the NBA draft after his freshman year. And by all accounts, he will be the number one pick in that draft if should he decide to come out. But this might be the big one right here, and this also might be a little bit of a reason why Badunga decided to go elsewhere. Sam, we've talked about this. We expected this to happen, but now that it has happened, what needs to happen now for Duke to land Cooper Flagg?
Well, and we'll give Jason credit in absentia for, I think, being the first one, at least on this show, to mention the possibility that Cooper Flagg was going to reclassify. I don't think he generated that himself. I know that's been kind of a background discussion in recruiting circles for over a year now, just given Cooper Flagg's age and his and his ability. And like you said, Donald, the general consensus that whether it's him or Cameron Boozer, those two have been the best players in high school over the last year, at least since the 2022 class were in high school. So big news that Flag has decided officially to reclassify. So he's now entering his senior year. And it means that, you know, we were talking about Flag in relation to the Boozer twins and the possibility that all three might end up at Duke. I think that the natural conclusion that you reach, if you think that Duke is in good position for all of those guys, is that this reclassification makes it more likely that Duke is able to land all three of them. I did talk before when we were discussing Flory Badunga, how there is, you know, you could see there being a bit of a logjam for a guy like Cooper Flagg. The difference is that Cooper Flagg is the like consensus best player in the class now. And whether it's Sean Stewart or Kyle Filipowski or TJ Power or name your, you know, big wing / front court Blue Devils, Cooper Flagg very possibly is beating all of them out for minutes. He's a starter from day one, like no doubt, at Duke or at any school that he goes to. So whatever program lands him is going to find minutes, and other guys in the rotation may suffer from that. But I think that is somewhat the price you pay for getting a kid who is this talented. I don't think there were any initial indications that this reclassification sort of changes the schools that he's looking at or his like announcement timeline. Hopefully we see him commit, whether it's to Duke or elsewhere. Hopefully we see him commit sooner than later so that we can either continue getting excited about him or move on. But the indications, at least in the early goings here, are that he has a strong interest in Duke. I know that he was on campus a couple weeks ago to visit John Shire and the staff there. So all signs good on the Cooper Flagg front, and I'll be very excited if Duke is able to land him.
It would be phenomenal. This dude is the real deal. Like he is phenomenal to watch. You know, watching him, you know, several games on TV. This kid is everywhere. He's on offense, he's on defense. You know, he's only 6'8", 6'9". He's not like a 7-footer that we're talking about here, but plays like one. And I think that's the big deal, is that he can play, you know, he can play at small forward, he can play at the four, he can play at the five, and he's going to disrespect everybody that he comes up against. Like that's the type of player we're talking about. So yeah, I'm with you. I think this timeline probably accelerates when he does make an announcement. I don't think he reclassifies now just to wait until the spring circuit to make his decision. I think he makes a decision early and basically works with that school to create a timeline where he can graduate on time, or at least early, and be able to get on campus for those summer workouts, which are so vital. We've talked about how the team is gelling over the summer with everybody being in Durham for workouts. Cooper Flagg is probably setting himself up so that he can be at whatever team he decides to go to. He can be at that team for the start of those summer workouts to gel with his team and really get into the college experience. So, you know, we've had this situation with Tyrese Proctor. He missed a lot of time last year because of the fact that he was playing for the Australian national team. I think this time around him, you know, being able to reclassify it this early means he's on a path where he wants to graduate early. He's set with everything, and that he can start his obligations with college very, very soon.
And I mentioned the positional logjam. Duke is in this embarrassment of riches situation this year, where a couple guys who we thought might be going to the NBA are coming back. Four guys, really, if you think about like any possibilities they were going to leave. Duke's got four more guys on the roster this year than four like elite guys they didn't think they were going to have in the aforementioned Filipowski and Proctor, in addition to Mark Mitchell and Jeremy Roach. So we will see if that trend at all continues next year. I talked about Sean Stewart already. Mark Mitchell, of course, is another one who would notionally be competing with Cooper Flagg for those, you know, big wing / front court minutes. So this commitment would sort of create a little bit more of a sense of urgency, I think, from some of the guys on the roster about, you know, performing or then potentially thinking about transferring. But it's too early to get there. Cooper Flagg is not committed yet. We don't know what's going to happen. So I will just continue to be excited for the possibility. And you know, obviously not forgetting that there's a whole season between now and when he shows up in college.
A great problem to have is to have to be able to play Tetris with minutes because you have a player of that magnitude. So we hope that happens and that this coaching staff has that problem of having to figure out where to put all these guys and how many minutes to play each. It's a great problem to have, but we will leave it there. Let's take a break. On the other side of the break, we're going to talk conference realignment. A lot has happened over the last couple of weeks. We will discuss it all after this. All right, y'all, we are back, and it's time to discuss everything that has happened in the form of conference realignment over the last couple of weeks. When I went to New Zealand and Australia back on July 24th, there was a Pac-12. Now it's a Pac-4, and in spite of everything else, the Big Ten has expanded, the Big 12 has expanded, the Pac-12 is now, again, the Pac-4. They may be the Pac-West. There's a lot that's happening right now, but we want to talk about it, not just in terms of the whole conference landscape, but really focusing in on the ACC. The ACC has also had some things that have happened over the last couple of weeks. First off, FSU kind of gave an ultimatum of sorts, or I guess like at least a public condemnation of the grant of rights deal that they all signed that has been kind of the bane of the conference's existence over the last couple of years. They have kind of said, you know, we're looking to try and leave, but we can't because we're trying to figure out how to get out of this land, this grant of rights thing. Also, because of the ACC trying to keep up with the Joneses, so to speak, we've heard reports over the last week or so that they have talked to three schools, at least had initial conversations about three schools potentially joining the ACC. Those three schools are Cal, Stanford, and SMU. Sam, first of all, you've been here. I've been abroad. It's hard to kind of keep up with the Pac-12 disappearing literally overnight. But bring us up to speed on what this landscape looks like right now and what it means for the ACC and really what it means for Duke.
Well, it really laid bare the value of certain programs over other programs when it comes to how conference realignment shakes out. And it's sort of funny that, you know, these conferences that we talk about, some of them have geographic distinctions right in their names, and some of them are just sort of known that way, right? Like the Big Ten is a Midwestern conference. The ACC is an East Coast conference and really used to be like just a Southeast Coast conference before it expanded north. The SEC by name is the Southeastern Conference. The Pac-12 by name is the conference in the West Coast. Increasingly, though, these conferences are more being aligned by, you know, the level of interest in their football programs. And you can see very clearly the way that the Big Ten and the SEC targeted these schools and their markets, and that they're looking at Stanford and Cal, who both have certainly like moments of glory in their football past, but not recent enough to be driving big eyeballs. They look at Stanford and see a litany of successful Olympic sports that frankly don't bring in any money. They're really just being funded from, you know, either from their Pac-12 proceeds or from other donations to the school. And the Big Ten and the SEC are collectively saying, you know who the valuable properties are? And they are just properties to them. I don't know that there's more cultural alignment between the Big Ten and Washington and Oregon than there is between the Big Ten and potentially, you know, Berkeley and Stanford, right? They already brought in USC and UCLA. They're saying, what are the best opportunities for us to get more TV eyeballs? It's Oregon, it's Washington, two teams that have actually played in the college football playoff. Not super recently, but both of them have, or at least played in BCS championship games, programs that have been nationally relevant, especially more so than Stanford and Cal have over the last 10 years since, I guess, since Stanford lost Jim Harbaugh to the NFL. Is really the last time either of these programs was really keen and nationally relevant. And then the same thing, you know, maybe to a lesser extent, but the Big 12 beefing up the conference after losing Texas and Oklahoma by taking Colorado and Utah and then Arizona and Arizona State. Not exactly the same profile nationally in terms of football, except for Utah among that group. But you know, for the most part, the somewhat competitive programs, maybe you give CU a bump for being in a good market rather than being in a good program. But this is how these schools are being evaluated now. And it's interesting to me that in particular, Stanford is being left out of the carousel here, at least in the, you know, in the recent iteration. Maybe that's because Cal Berkeley is such a bad program to add, given the state of its finances and the state of its football program, that you sort of, if you assume that all these Pac-12 teams come in pairs, that you don't really want Berkeley and you really just want Stanford, and that the Washington and Oregon schools have broken up the traditional pairings of Washington and Washington State, as well as Oregon and Oregon State. But all of that is sort of outside of where we are with Duke, because the chatter around, post the Pac-12 falling apart and now currently being a Pac-4, a conference that cannot continue to exist, at least as far as NCAA tournament eligibility is concerned. So there's a lot there. It seems like there are a lot of options for these remaining schools in terms of adding other teams, maybe going to other conferences where they're going to have much lighter TV payouts, but they'll still be able to compete in Division I conferences like the Mountain West, where they'll get small payouts, but they'll still be in a competitive league. Unknown how all of that shakes out. But as it relates to Duke, the chatter as of Sunday morning is still that the ACC is considering Stanford and Berkeley, but that four schools, North Carolina, North Carolina State, Florida State, and Clemson, are not on board with this addition. The ACC would need at least one of those schools to change their mind to get to the supermajority that they need to approve any additions to the conference. But so at least according to the reporting, Duke is on board with adding Stanford and Cal to the ACC's lineup. However, let me tell you what an enormous nightmare it would be for the ACC to add these two schools, all right? Flying from Tallahassee or Miami to South Bend is like a couple hours of a trip. You could do it that afternoon and still play the game. It's not great, but you can do it. You can fly from Miami to Boston. It takes about 3 hours. To fly from Boston to San Francisco, heading west, takes about 6 or 7 hours in the air. It's about, you know, it's approximately the same if you're coming from Syracuse or Pittsburgh. Maybe you shave an hour and a half off that trip. Those are long trips. Duke does, you all follow Duke men's basketball. Duke's going to play in Arizona next year as part of the home and home series with the Wildcats that they set up that's starting this fall in Durham. Duke very rarely travels away from Eastern time. Occasionally they'll play in Central time, like they'll play games in Chicago. But Coach K has long avoided scheduling on the West Coast. John Shire, except for this one Arizona game, this one off game, which I'm sure they're going to plan, you know, days of rest around, doesn't do
and,
this. For
and they have a year to plan it.
Yeah. And they, right, so they are going to clear the schedule for this thing. I doubt that Duke is playing in Durham and then 2 days later, they're playing in Tucson. Having all these games in the San Francisco Bay Area would be a nightmare for the ACC schools scheduling this. And I don't care what people from the Big Ten say about adding Washington and Oregon and UCLA and USC. It is going to stink to be every team that's at Penn State or Rutgers or Maryland or Ohio State or Michigan, any of those that's not the football team that only plays once a week, being on the baseball team or the volleyball team or the soccer team or the lacrosse team. I don't know if they play lacrosse on the West Coast. I don't think they do. But being any of those athletes that's playing games multiple times a week, and having to travel and basketball, you know, basketball is in that group, is going to be a nightmare. The players are going to hate it. You know, maybe it'll be cool because they'll get to go to more places. But I do not see this being a great outcome for the players. And I honestly don't know. I guess it's just a financial thing for the athletic department and feeling jealous that these other conferences have, you know, are getting, like, you know, Rutgers is getting more money from their TV deal than Duke is. And so that makes us feel like, oh, well, shouldn't Duke be getting more? But man, I can't imagine being the student athletes who have to do that much extra travel. And sure, they would figure out how to bundle the games together the way that the Pac-12 is traditionally done, where, you know, the teams travel in pairs to each other, because even all being on the West Coast, they're still much more spread out than like everyone in the SEC is. But I don't know. I don't love it. It doesn't seem to make much sense to me. And it's also sort of an admission, not that we need to be convinced otherwise, but it is kind of an admission that the ACC is just, you know, picking up the dregs of whatever the Big Ten and the SEC and to some extent the Big 12 didn't want.
You know, I think when you talk about, you have to kind of take football and even men's basketball and set them aside when you talk about the logistics of travel. As much as you just are correct in how the logistics of those games are going to be bad, they have one thing over the rest of the sports, and that's they have charter travel, right? Like, football does not fly Delta. They don't fly United. They don't fly American. They don't fly Southwest. They have charter flights. And I travel all the time for soccer. I'm all over the place, as you know. I see all of these Olympic sports from all these different schools, and they're on the same planes as I am. They're in middle seats. They're, you know, on, you know, flying standby because their flight was canceled. You see this all the time. Games get canceled because, or postponed because people can't get to the places because of weather, because of mechanical delays or what have you. Football and men's basketball do not have to deal with that. And it's still going to be an issue for them because we can't get some of these guys. And I'm not saying Duke is complicit in this, but there, I went to Miami as well. I know a lot of people at all these schools. There are guys who can't show up for class on Monday after playing at home. They're going to go to, you know, from, especially like even Rutgers, take Rutgers, for example. Rutgers is going to go to UCLA for a game and then come back. And then you're going to expect all those guys to be at class on Monday. That's not going to happen. Like, the just jet lag is going to rule you out for a day. Like, that's how that works. They're going to spend all day Sunday flying back because they're not going to fly. They're either going to take a red eye, which is going to be terrible, or they're going to fly back all day Sunday, which renders Sunday obsolete. And then they have to catch up on schoolwork and all this stuff on Monday. That's going to be some of the new reality for all of these athletes. But really, when it comes to the volleyball players, the golf players, right? Like, fencing, swimming, Cal Stanford, very big at swimming, right? Swimming and diving. Duke, very big at swimming and diving. It's going to be, if they play, like, they're going to have to travel cross country to do that. Guys, that's not something that you could just fly across the country and go, all right, let's jump in the pool and do the swim meet. Like, they need preparation time as well. And being able to fly commercial, or at least having to fly commercial, doesn't render you the ability to do that. So I think this is what's going to be lost in this. Yeah, sure, the money might be there for some of these teams and some of these schools, but the logistics are going to be a nightmare, and that's going to really strain some of these departments to the point where you have to consider, I mean, was it Stanford that even had to eliminate some schools or some sports recently? We talked about Maryland having to eliminate so many of those Olympic sports that they had because they were spending so many resources on football. And that's not including adding the West Coast schools that they just added in the Big Ten. This is going to
cause Maryland to get their butts kicked in every big game they play. In
every sport. Yeah. Like, this is going to really endanger some of those non-revenue sports. And ladies and gentlemen, that includes women's basketball for some of these schools, because for some of these schools, again, women's basketball, they fly commercial. They don't fly charter. Like, they have to stay in airports.
There's not a big gate revenue for women's basketball in a lot of these schools unless they have sort of an established even Duke, which has a consistently not top five, but like consistently top 10, top 15-ish type women's basketball program. It's still like Cameron Indoor is not full for women's basketball games. People are showing up. People are paying for tickets. I'm not sure that women's basketball is like paying for its own program. Like, even women's basketball at Duke and at some of these other prominent women's basketball schools has to dip into the revenue that's coming in from the football contracts to keep things going.
Right. I think there's maybe a couple of programs on the women's side that make money, right? It's probably UConn, maybe South Carolina, maybe Tennessee. Maybe. That's about it. That's about it. And so for a lot of these schools, and then again, some of those teams still have to fly commercial. Like I've seen Tennessee's team struggling into middle seats and maybe an exit row, but they're not flying first class and they're not flying charter to some of these games. And I think that's where a lot of people are going to miss the boat, because I think all the glitz and glamour about the money and having these guys on TV for football is going to make it where some of these programs are endangered. And I think that's going to be the real issue.
I'll tell you something that it's cool for is that it's going to be fun to see more like Oregon, Ohio State football games, right? Like undoubtedly, right, some of these football games are going to be great. It's going to be more fun seeing them. It's going to be tough on NCAA tournament seeding as these conferences get bigger and the big guys get farther away from the middle guys to distinguish between middling to low level major conference teams against top mid-major teams. That's going to be frustrating. Not something Duke's going to have to deal with unless the ACC gets downgraded. And then we've talked before about how there's always a possibility that the end state of this is that the SEC and the Big Ten are the only conferences left, or at least the only major conferences left. Like the Mountain West Conference exists. It has great football and men's basketball programs. Rarely do those programs actually compete for national titles. Same thing in the American and you know, whatever happens now to the Pac-12. Notre Dame's probably the only program like nationally that maintains even a pseudo independent profile and manages to be competitive in these sports. Obviously it's in the ACC for basketball, but not for football. Stanford might and Cal might choose to go the way of Notre Dame and take on an independent football schedule and figure the rest out in a different conference. I don't know. It is interesting to me, coming back to the ACC, Donald, that there are those four schools that don't want Stanford and Cal to join, and everybody else seems to be on board with it. I'm curious what Duke's thinking is on including them versus not. It might just be the survival of the conference and that maybe they bring the sort of average value of the ACC up, because I imagine that Wake Forest and Pittsburgh and maybe some of these other schools have less of a draw than Stanford and Cal do. I don't know. I don't know how valuable any of them are as television properties, if you will, if you want to value all of this in terms of assets as opposed to talking about them like they're schools and people. But we'll see. We don't know where this ends up as far as ACC programs. Like Florida State seems to be banging the drum about how they need to be making more money to be competitive with the SEC. So I don't know. It's all very frustrating and confusing that we can't just accelerate to the end state here and find out what happens.
Yeah. Well, you also mentioned, right, that there's what, 6-7 years ago, 10 years ago, when conference realignment happened in this kind of robust way, the first time it was about TV markets. Right. And so, while those aren't the main reasons why conference realignment is happening now, I'm sure those are all qualities that are still, you know, looked at and considered when it comes to trying to add a team to a conference. For example, Cal Stanford are in the San Francisco Bay Area market, which is one of the biggest TV markets in the country. It's also one of the most, you know, fertile places for recruitment when it comes to football. A lot of great football players come from that area. A lot of great basketball players come from San Francisco, San Jose, Oakland, that area. So I'm sure some of these schools are like, hey, another opportunity to kind of find a fertile recruiting base from which you can gather a lot of players. And also, again, some of these non-revenue sports, a lot of athletes come from the San Francisco Bay Area. So maybe that is what's enticing some of them. Also, both are great academic institutions, which again is way down the line when it comes to consideration. But for some of these schools, like a Duke or Miami or even a Wake Forest, maybe that is encouraging to them that, hey, we're going after a school that is great in academics as well as having high profile non-revenue sports and even, you know, football and basketball programs that people at least consider somewhat relevant. So it's interesting. I just think, you know, the ACC I remember when they brought in Louisville and Notre Dame, and everyone's like, yo, they don't touch the Atlantic coast. How can they be part of the Atlantic Coast Conference? And now we're going to have an all-coast conference with, if you add Cal and Stanford. It's all interesting to me. I think the quickness with how it's happened, again, I was gone for 2 weeks and the Pac-12 disintegrated in 2 weeks. Like, after a whole summer of being intact, after a whole couple of years of kind of fighting off some of these, you know, other big, you know, big conferences from stealing some of their teams, they just went bye-bye in the span of a couple of weeks. I think that is what's the most shocking to me. But at the end of the day, the ACC, I think they're going to have to address this grant of rights issue. We've discussed this on the show many times, but that grant of rights issue is going to be an issue until it is resolved. But I think the only thing that the ACC can say is if they get rid of it, then some of these teams that you talked about, the Clemsons and the Florida States, maybe even the UNCs, the UVAs, they're gone. And I think that is where they're trying to figure out how to keep this intact, this conference intact, while making it more enticing for other teams to want to be a part of it and to keep some of the people at home. So a lot is still going on. It feels like this is going to happen more over the next couple of weeks. We're going to get maybe some more resolution up until the start of college football season, which is in just a couple of weeks. So we will leave it there for that.
Donald, I have one intriguing thought exercise for you.
Okay, let's do it.
What happens, or do you think that there's a possibility that a bunch of the SEC schools band together and decide to vote out schools like Vanderbilt, or that the Big Ten schools get together and decide to vote out schools like Rutgers and Northwestern at some point? Or are these schools, like these schools that sort of have these middling programs? And by the way, if Duke was in the SEC, that there might be a similar conversation, other than the fact that Duke has arguably the most basketball program. But do you think there's a world where we get to the point in conference realignment where the haves within the have conferences decide to kick out the have nots that are in the have conferences?
Oh yeah. I think we're way closer than most people think. I think when you talk about, again, if the SEC is able to pull Florida State, Clemson, maybe even a Miami away from the ACC, they would gladly remove probably Vandy, Missouri. They probably kick those teams out in a heartbeat to add those two, because again, the money that they're going to get, whatever payouts they have to give teams to go bye-bye, is going to be offset by the amount of money that is coming in with these schools. And I honestly think for, in the case of Florida State and Clemson, that's kind of what they're waiting for, is that opening where they can A, get out of the grant of rights, but also the SEC kind of says, yeah, we'll make room for you over here. We just got to get rid of these two teams over here. I think in the Big Ten, I don't know about Rutgers. I would say probably Rutgers, because there's not a lot of loyalty there, right? They just got there. Maybe Maryland gets booted again, you know. But the ones that I heard about were kind of more established teams: Minnesota, Northwestern, Purdue, Indiana. Like, those are schools that were being thrown around, and I don't necessarily think that those teams are going to go out of the Big Ten. I think there's, again, a lot of loyalty there, a lot of rivalries that have been built between schools there, enough where they can keep them. But I do think we're almost at the point where, yeah, I think there's going to be teams that say, hey, we'll come in as long as, you know, you make room for us. And SEC and Big Ten could say, yeah, let's do some trading here. You know, I'll give you these two schools for this school to be named later. Right. Like,
in a way, they, you know, the if you take the collective action of the schools that have left the Pac-12 for the Big Ten and the schools that have left the Pac-12 to go to the Big 12, they've sort of like done this voting themselves. It doesn't seem like they colluded with each other on it. But there's a little bit of like, all right, who are we like voting off the island here? The other thing that I'd be curious about, and I have a number of friends that are University of Colorado alumni, but I'd love to know the discussion there about CU, which left the Big 12 just a few years ago, to now go back to the Big 12, to not play Texas and to not play Nebraska, the schools that like were there, you know, were some of their big rivals once upon a time.
Nebraska and Colorado was one of the big rivalries in college football.
Was a real rivalry.
Yeah, they did not like each other. No, those games were also always great. Like,
but they don't play in the same conference. So, anyway,
I think also,
I'm good here.
Yeah. Well, even just to put a bow in it, I think before, even when we talked about conference realignment a few months ago, the whole, teams were kind of tied together. That has gone by the wayside too. As you mentioned, the Oregon teams split up, the Washington teams split up, there's a lot of, I think there's going to be a lot of interesting scenarios here where I think before you could say, hey, Virginia Tech, who entered the ACC because UVA lobbied for them to join because they were kind of bound by this. Will UVA or Virginia Tech, will they leave and take the other with them? I don't know that's necessarily going to happen. NC State and UNC have always been considered to be banded together by the legislature. Could UNC say, no, let's take Duke and let's go to the Big Ten, or take Duke and go somewhere else? That's a question too. There's a lot of things that need to be kind of sorted out. But at the end of the day, right now we're in the middle of chaos, and we just need to have chaos kind of subside before we kind of see what has transpired and how college football and the rest of college sports go from there. So let's leave it there. We will end it here on episode 530 of the Duke Basketball Roundup. Again, Sam, thank you for joining me. For Jason in absentia, we hope we'll see you soon. We're going to probably take a week or two off, just so Jason can get back from Norway and Iceland, where he's having his great vacation. We have a lot of things coming up. Remember, we have a bunch of affiliate links that you can use to also help save money, and you can support this show. Fanatics, Home Field Apparel, you guys can get 15% off at Home Field using DBR Podcast on that code. A lot of stuff that they have released in anticipation of the upcoming football season and basketball season. So go check it out. Great, great Duke stuff. Other schools, if you want to support them as well. And they also even have some cool stuff that are just blanks. If you just like wearing blank t-shirts, they have a blank Duke blue t-shirt that you can wear out in the open for everyone to see. So go buy Home Field, go buy Fanatics, use our affiliate link, linktree.com/DBR podcast. You can find that. But for Sam and for Jason Absentia, I am Donald. This is episode 530. And now it is time for the Duke band to play us out and take us home.